Greetings, everyone, and welcome to The Law Hour, an editorial review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour, an editorial review, is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about The Law Hour, an editorial review, please visit my webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, The Law Hour, an editorial review, brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on Where Is It in the Law? When we come back. Well, how many laws did Moses give us in the Mosaic Law, and how many laws has the state given us in our secular government? Well, Moses gave us 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments. The state at last count has given us some 2.5 million laws. Well, Peter said that we ought to obey God rather than men in Acts 5, verse 29. And Congress said that we ought to voluntarily apply the teachings of the Scripture in the lives of families, individuals, and societies. And our Supreme Court has said that there is a higher loyalty than loyalty to this country, and that is loyalty to God. They said that in Seeger versus United States. Now, every authority is in agreement. Congress, the Supreme Court, and God Almighty Himself, that the Scriptures are the final authority on law. Now, if you'd like to learn these 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments, and how to use them against government intrusion into your God-given rights, it's a right, a duty, and an obligation that I contend we owe to ourselves, our families, and our society. And I teach all 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments, along with the penalties for the violation of these laws. Now, why don't you make it a point to regain your First Amendment right to free exercise this year? The First Amendment is the gateway to the Second and to your whole Bill of Rights. The law of God may be old, but it's not old-fashioned, and it's very relevant to our lives and our rights today. Now, if you'd like to learn more, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package first? That's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call and order yours right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the Mosaic Law School is available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, you can go to the website georgegordon.org, click on to the email and send an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. I'm going to add a postscript or a footnote to last week's series of programs called The Milk of Human Kindness is Not Pasteurized. I gave you the address that was in the book that I've had for 20 years. And probably those addresses and those publishers are not very good any longer. And we happened to be looking on the web the other day, and Dr. Douglas has three websites, three current websites. You can just go to the web and look up drdouglas.com. That's www.drdouglass.com. And that'll take you to his website. He's got two other websites. Let me jot those down, or you can jot them down. Let me give them to you. www.rhinopublishing.com. Again, that's www.rhinopublishing.com. Then he has a newsletter. And that's at www.realhealthnews.com. Again, that's www.realhealthnews.com. I think if you went to any one of those three websites, you'd stand a better chance of getting that book called The Milk of Human Kindness is Not Pasteurized. According to the website, it's still in publication, and you can get it from the website itself. I forgot which one of the three. There's the three websites. DrDouglas.com. I just got a letter this week, kind of a question type letter, but kind of called me up short here and jerked my chain a little bit, and so I thought I'd share it with you. as we get into where is it in the law? Where does the law say that? Oftentimes you hear me make statements over the air, and I'm sure that probably most of you say, well, where does that fool think he gets that kind of information? Or what makes him believe that? Or why does he believe that's true? Or where did he get that kind of nonsense anyway? And a fellow by the name of Ray, Raymond, gives me this letter. He says, I enjoy your show very much. Thank you. Now, here's my question. I've often heard it said that certain government documents are, in fact, contracts, adhesion contracts, such as driver's licenses and voting registrations and social security numbers, that I have unknowingly presumed to have known or entered into. My question is this. Is it explicitly stated or recorded in any law, case, record, statute, code, etc., that this is indeed a fact? In other words, I know by repetitive hearsay that this is the case. But has the government ever admitted, stated, or acknowledged that this is a fact of law? Or is it merely an assumption made by implication, deduction, or reason? I know of the legal concept of ipso facto, but that sounds like a de facto law to me and not a positive law. I don't doubt the truth of the assertion that these documents are operating as contracts. I was just wondering if any proof positive existed of these assertions on paper. Now, I have asked this question before, but did not get a response. If there's any reason why, please tell me so. Maybe it's a foolish question, or maybe you think me too lazy to do my own research. If you would point me in the right direction, I'll try my best to find it on my own. I was just wondering if you had seen any such thing yourself. Maybe I'm way off base, in which case I am just wasting my time trying to find such proof. Now, I understand that you're a very busy man, and if I am wasting your time, just say so, and I'll not bother you again. Thank you. Fare thee well, and Godspeed to you and to the truth. Sincerely, Ray. Well, I don't remember Ray writing me a letter in the past and asking this specific question concerning contracts, adhesion contracts, and etc. And if you did, it's one of many letters that comes across my desk, and maybe I didn't even see it. My mail is filtered, and it has to be, so let me explain that to you for a minute. President Bush, for instance, doesn't read every letter that every American sends to him. It all gets filtered through various processes. And as you get into the business world, you know, I'm an old-timey businessman, old contractor, you'll find out that pretty soon you have more customers, or you have more listeners, or you have more people than you can talk to or you can answer in a 24-hour day. So let me apologize for my staff if, in fact, you wrote a letter and then the letter didn't get through or we didn't answer the question. We're pretty careful about answering these questions, and typically we answer most questions that come by email on the email form itself. And oftentimes I don't answer those questions. They're answered by our staff here. And then if the staff can't answer a question, you know, a lot of times questions are pretty routine. You know, where is this or where is that? And, you know, somebody will say, well, you'll find that in Bouvier's Law Dictionary under this, or you'll find that in American Jurisprudence Encyclopedia under this or that or something else. You know, those are pretty routine questions. And then a question like this one comes up. Now, this is a pretty involved question. It goes right to the heart and core of the entire philosophy of law. Where does law come from? That's what it really boils down to. And Ray here is asking specific questions. He says, well, Gordon, I hear you make these statements. You know, this is a contract. Okay, where in the law does it say that it's a contract? I haven't seen that. And that's quite understandable. There's a number of methodologies that we follow when we use to research out a legal topic to get an answer. Is it in the statutes? Is it in the codes? Here's the question. It says, is it explicitly stated or recorded in any law, any case, any record, any statute, or any code? And the answer to that, Ray, is yes, it is. And I can say that unequivocally, because if I said to you that your driver's license is a contract, that might just be my opinion. Where in the statute, where in any rules, definitions, regulations, codes, etc., does it say that a license is a contract? But it's more fundamental than that. What is a contract? And what is a license? Well, we have various sources of materials that we go to first of all define what is a contract. What is a contract? And before we could understand the connecting link between a license and a contract, we'd have to go to Bouvier's Law Dictionary. Or if there's some other way to do this, I don't know what it is. But I know how to determine what a contract is, and I know how to determine what a law is. I know how to determine what a source of law is and whether the law is still on the books and still valid or not. It's called code pleading. Code pleading. And I thought I'd give you a couple of examples of this thing called code pleading and give you some sources of information. After all, Ray said, I know of the legal concept of ipso facto, but that sounds like a de facto law to me and not a positive law. Well, I guess we ought to take a look at ipso facto, de facto, and positive law and find out what is the difference between a license and a contract. What is a law anyway? Who makes laws? Where do laws come from? These are all vital questions that law school students go through when they go through the legal training process. Now, unfortunately, most Americans are trained in such things as driver's education, but they're never trained in law. Although driver's education has a little bit of law with it, they'll tell you, you have to have a driver's license. But did anybody ever tell you why you have to have a driver's license? Have we always had driver's licenses? And why is driving a privilege and not a right? Why is voting a right and not a privilege? Is voting a right? Or is it a privilege? What makes rights? What makes privileges? And what's the difference between the two? And what's the authority for rights? And what is the authority for a privilege? All of these questions we'll answer because, Ray, you asked. So I'm going to tell you. But I'm not going to tell you that this is George Gordon's opinion, because George Gordon's opinion doesn't mean anything. Now, Chief Justice Rehnquist. Now, there's a guy whose opinion's pretty weighty. And the Congress of the United States, you know, when a majority of them vote in a certain direction and they enact a law, now there's a body that has some weight and authority. So the Supreme Court has some weight and authority. In fact, as you go down the scale, you can even find lesser courts than the Supreme Court make law. And we'll take a look at what is a law anyway. And am I bound by that law? Is everyone bound by every law that is enacted? Or do those laws affect certain classes or certain individuals, and they don't affect other classes and they don't affect other individuals? You've heard me talk about that from time to time. And oftentimes on the air, I can't spend the time to prove a material fact. If I said, well, you know, that's an adhesion contract. You know, some of you are probably sitting there saying, what in the hell is an adhesion contract? What's the difference between an adhesion contract or an adhesion contract? How many different kinds of contracts are there anyway? I mean, is there more than one kind of contract? Well, all of these are questions that I contend we should be learning in high school, because law affects everything that you do every day. I mean, every time you get in your car and drive down the street, you're governed by 2,000 traffic laws in your state. Do you know all 2,000 traffic laws of your state? And until I made that statement, did you even know that there was 2,000 traffic laws in your state? How do I know that there's 2,000 traffic laws in your state and that there's not 4,000 or 1,362 or some other number? How do I know that there's 2,000 traffic laws in your state? Where did that information come from anyway? And can you prove that? George Gordon, can you prove that there's 2,000 traffic laws in the state of Idaho? And where would you go to find that information? Well, we'll answer that question for you as we progress along. He says, I've asked this question before, but I didn't get a response. Well, if you didn't get a response, ask it again. And that's what Ray did here. He said, well, I didn't get a response before, so I'll ask this question again. Now, ordinarily, we answer questions on the email or in letters that come in. And I just write a short response on here, and I would send this letter back. This is a little bit more than a short response, you know. He's asking a pretty involved question here. Is it expressly stated or recorded in any law, case, record, statute, or code? And I said, yes, it is. Or he asks me, is this merely an assumption made by implication, deduction, or reason? And the answer is no, no. If I were making these statements by my own human reason, they wouldn't have any weight or authority at all. If I just came to the conclusion that, well, there's an implication here of the two, that's not proof. That won't stand up in court. In court, we have to have names, dates, times, places, facts, witnesses, and evidence. That's called proof. And one side comes in and proves their case, and the other side comes in and proves their case. Can both sides prove their case? What in the hell is proof? You know, one guy's got to be right, and the other guy has to be wrong. And that's why we have conclusions of law. So a judge writes up an opinion when he gets through with the case. The jury comes in with a verdict. The judge writes up an opinion, and he files the opinion in the case. That's where we get things like Miranda versus Arizona or Yoder versus Wisconsin. And let me assure you, right, George Gordon didn't write Yoder versus Wisconsin or Miranda versus Arizona. I don't make any of these laws, rules, and regulations, customs, usages, or practices. I don't make law for people. Now, once in a while I make a law, and I'll show you who it is that makes these laws. You and I can make a law. It's called a contract. A contract is a law. And all law is predicated upon contract. The law of God that comes out of the Bible is predicated upon contract. It's an offer with an acceptance over time with consideration. You've probably heard me say that before. Where did I get the idea that a contract is an offer with an acceptance over time with consideration? Did I just ipso facto come up to that conclusion? Is that merely George Gordon's human reason? Or is there some code, rule, regulation, custom, usage, or practice somewhere, some court, who said in writing that you can see with your own eyeballs that that is in fact the case? Or is it just my opinion and there's nobody else that shares that opinion? I remember one time I was on a talk show and a listener called up and he said, we were talking about the common law, and he said, you know, I went to law school and let me tell you what the common law is. And so this listener, he spouted off about what he thought the common law was. And when he got all through, I said, well, that's all well and good. That's all well and good, and I'm sure that the law school that you went to and the beliefs and the opinions that you came out with are truly and sincerely held. But that's not my understanding of the common law, and I got my understanding from Blackstone's commentaries. And you know, that's what makes opinion. Hell, even the Supreme Court divides 5-4 oftentimes on their opinion concerning the law. Now, the law comes out 5-4, and there's a decision made, and a policy is established, whether we like it or not. I mean, you can sit there and argue about Roe versus Wade, and I'm not here to argue about the goodness or the wickedness and evil of Roe versus Wade. I don't make the law. I'm just here to tell you it's the law of the land. That's the way it's construed. And if you go into court and argue this, there's the likely outcome of your case. Oftentimes people will call the law school and they ask me a question concerning the law. And I say, well, based upon what the court's already decided, based upon the law as it's already established, here's the answer to the question. And people will start to argue with me. And they'll say, well, that's not right. I don't know if it's right or not. I don't know if it's wrong. I'm just telling you that's the way it is. And the public in America has decided over abortion, or divided over abortion about 50-50. About half the people are in favor of abortion, and about half the people are opposed to it. And then there's stripes of people in between. You know, they come up to a conclusion. They say, "Well, I'm in favor of abortion where rape is involved." Oh, well, okay. Another guy comes along. He says, "Well, I'm opposed to abortion in any form, any fashion. Period." Oh, okay. All right, that's your opinion. Another guy comes up and he says, well, I'm in favor of abortion in all circumstances. After all, it's a woman's body and she has a right to choose. Okay. Okay. That's your opinion. Now, aside from those opinions out there, there are authorities and there are forces called the police power of the state. And they can bring the police power to bear against you, and if need be, they'll kill you and drag your dead, cold body away. Once in a while, you'll see a sign that says, I think it was Carlton Heston made this kind of famous statement. He said, they'll pry my gun from my cold, dead fingers. Well, okay. If that's what we need to do, that's what we'll do. We will pry your gun from your cold, dead fingers. If that's the way you want it, by God, that's the way we'll do it. And sometimes it comes down to that. Sometimes we have to apply the police power of the state against people and kill them, because it's the only way to control them. And somebody comes along and says, "Well, that's not right." I don't know if it's right or wrong. I don't make those kind of decisions. George Gordon didn't decide Roe versus Wade. I don't decide whether it's good or bad or right or wrong. I'm just telling you as a commentator, as a teacher, you know, let me tell you how the courts have ruled in the past, and here's where you go to find that information, and here's the way you use the legal encyclopedia and the U.S. Supreme Court reports, and here's Bouvier's Law Dictionary. And I get people, you know, say, well, Black's Law Dictionary is the standard and it's the best. Well, okay. Okay. You know, people have different opinions concerning different things, but that doesn't make that right. Your opinion doesn't make right and wrong. Neither does mine. And the state isn't always right. The state is at loggerheads against God. And I know that makes a lot of people mad. God, you know, as soon as you hear the word, you know, people's faces just go into contortions sometimes. I didn't make God, and I can't make him go away. I did not make thou shalt not steal, and I can't make that law go away either. I didn't decide thou shalt not commit adultery. I've often said that if there's anything better than adultery, God kept it for himself. If God made anything better than a pig to eat, he kept it for himself. I don't make these laws, rules, and regulations. Neither do you. That's the bottom line. Neither do you. And in the final analysis, when we have a division of opinion, somebody has to make a decision. And that war in Iraq is an example of it. You know, you sit there and you say, well, that war in Iraq is illegal and it's immoral and all that. There's nothing illegal about the war in Iraq. Illegal by whose standards? Yours? Who in the hell made you God? Who in the hell made you the standard? You know, I sometimes listen to people's opinions, and I try to be broad-minded, you know. And we got this PETA outfit. You ever heard of PETA? You know, this is the people, you know, they're opposed to, they're in favor of ethical treatment of animals and so on. And they're entitled to their opinion, but they're not entitled to enforce their opinions upon all the rest of us. Vegetarians, you know, don't want to eat meat, and I think that vegetarians should have a right to eat vegetables. I don't think vegetarians should impose their vegetarian philosophies on me or you or anybody else. And after all, that's what societies are all about. It's one political group over here trying to enforce its will, its power, its ideology off on other people, and I think that that's stretching a little bit. That causes wars. You know, it causes people to come unhinged and fly off the handle. The Bible is called the perfect law of liberty. The perfect law of liberty. It has 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments in it. And I subscribe to that philosophy because you have to have some laws around someplace. Just take two of us on an island in the South Pacific. Just you and me, Ray. Just the two of us. Do you know that you and I have to have a law? Yeah, we got to have a law. You know, I got a bed over here that I made. I went out and worked, and I cut down a bunch of palm trees and or palm fronds, and I made me a real neat bed. And you don't. You don't have a real neat bed. You just got sand to sleep on. And I've got this real neat bed. Now, I spent 6 hours working on my bed because I want to have a good night's sleep. And you come over, and you look at my bed, and you say, "Hey, Gordon, that's a pretty neat bed you got over there." And I say, "Yeah, Ray, that's a pretty neat bed I've got. I work real long and hard on this bed over here." And you say, "Well, George, you should share that bed with me." And I say, "Ray, you should have made your own bed, just like I did." And Ray, you look at me and you say, "Well, Gordon, you know, you're a bourgeoisie capitalist fascist pig because you've got a bed and I don't have one. And I believe in practicing from each according to his ability and to each according to his need. And you've got a bed and I need it." And you know, that's the substance of war. That's what the problem is. So God came along, whoever this guy God is, and he came up with a neat solution. It says, "Thou shalt not steal," Ray. "Leave on my bed alone, and go make it your own bed. And he that doesn't work shouldn't eat. And he that doesn't work shouldn't have a neat bed to sleep on. And I should, because I worked hard and I made my bed." And so you and I, Ray, have to have an agreement. And it's either that or you and I are going to have constant war or constant problems. Let's try food. On your end of the island, and we're going to say it's your end of the island, it's the end that you're occupying. You got banana trees, and down on my end of the island, we got a lot of coconut trees. Now, I don't know how you got your end of the island, and I don't know how I got my end of the island, so I just walked down to your end of the island, and I pick some bananas, and you get kind of upset, and you say, "These are my bananas." And I say, "Well, who in the hell gave you these bananas? What makes these bananas your bananas any more than my bananas?" And you walk down to my end of the island and you start picking coconuts, and I say, "Hey, Ray, those are my coconuts." Now, this is where property and property rights come in, and this is why we have a law that says, "Thou shalt not steal." Well, who established this property right in these bananas or these coconuts? Well, evolutionists come along and say, "Well, I guess survival of the fittest and the strongest man." Well, I don't know how big you are, Ray. I mean, yeah, I've never met you. And maybe you're bigger than I am, and maybe you can take whichever end of the island you want. Hell, maybe you can take the whole damn island. I don't know. But, you know, if there's two of us on here, it looks like to me the two of us are going to have to be able to get along together, aren't we? And this is why we have government, and this is why we have parliaments and legislative bodies to enact laws to come up with rules. So in the final analysis, laws in reality are nothing more than rules by which we can live together and we can function together. That's all. You know, a law, a rule, a regulation, custom, usage, or practice. And so typically, at least here when I was a kid, you know, growing up in Anglo-Saxon administration, we started off teaching young children, "Thou shalt not steal," and "Thou shalt not commit adultery." I mean, we started off with the Ten Commandments. And that got to be obnoxious, and people said, "Well, we don't like the Ten Commandments. We want to throw those out of school, and we want to replace it with something else." And we did. We replaced it with humanism. We replaced it with the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto. From each according to his ability and to each according to his need, share and share alike. And that's the philosophy. That's the educational format that we use in the United States today. Well, how do you like it? I didn't make it. I'm just reporting to you what you and I both know and can see and hear every day. So I think that it's a pretty poor philosophy, and I think that as an operation of law, it doesn't work very well, and that's because if we're going to share and share alike, that means I got to share my bed with you, and I worked 6 hours making that bed, remember, and you didn't work at all. And it really gets down to, when you take a look at law, law is the foundation by which we equitably distribute the fruits of our labor, and we do that by contract. And so when we look at land and land claiming, it comes from the Bible. There's a settled rules and regulations that deal with land. And so in Leviticus chapter 25, there's a law that says, "The land is mine. The land shall not be sold forever." So here's a fundamental of law, whether you like it or not. All of the land on planet Earth belongs to a guy named God, and he says, "That's mine." And I've got 15 laws here that regulate the use of my property, my land. And if you want this land, you go out and claim it. And you can claim all of the land that you can use, occupy, and possess. Use, occupation, and possession, then, is the primary function or the primary methodology by which we claim and use land. Who came up with that idea? Well, God did, and the source of the information is Leviticus chapter 25. I didn't write it. I'm just reporting it. And when our founding fathers created our Constitution and Bill of Rights and the Declaration of Independence and the founding documents and so on, they followed a particular form or philosophy of life called the common law. And on this broadcast, from time to time, I have mentioned to you the origin of the common law. And the guy who wrote the best treatise that I know of on the origin of the common law is a guy by the name of E. Raymond Capt, C-A-P-T. So I'm just going to flip over here to one of my books here. I'm in the tax book now. So if you went to school here at the Gordon Law School, and you went through my class on tax and status, in chapter 28, called The Common Law, we would take a look at a book called Missing Links Discovered in Assyrian Tablets. And we would discover from this chapter in this book the origin of the common law. Now somebody's going to say to me, "Ray, who in the hell makes this guy Capt the authority on the common law?" Well, I guess that's what debate and controversy is all about, isn't it? Now, the fellow that is recognized by most authorities as being the authority on Anglo-Saxon administration is called Blackstone. His name was Lord Blackstone. He's not the only legal writer. He's not the only guy in the world that ever wrote a legal treatise, but he's a pretty famous guy. He wrote a book back in 1757. He was an Englishman. He's called Lord Blackstone. He was a famous judge. And I was reading Blackstone's commentaries, and I noticed that Blackstone was making a lot of citations that came out of the Bible. So it was a time in English administration of law that we referred to the Bible as the basis or the foundation of law. And Anglo-Saxon administration comes from the Bible. Who says so? Blackstone? E. Raymond Capt? Bouvier's Law Dictionary? All of the authorities? Does that make it true? Well, it wouldn't necessarily make it true, but I believe that it's true, based upon this principle of law that says, at the mouth of two witnesses or at the mouth of three witnesses shall the matter be established. So if we can come up with two or three sources of authority, that'll pretty well establish it. So when I go into court and I want to establish a legal precedent or a legal principle, we follow Deuteronomy 19, verse 15. To this day, the courts of America follow this principle of law. At the mouth of two witnesses or at the mouth of three witnesses shall the matter be established. And the judge will almost invariably require that I bring in two or three authorities. If I can bring in Bouvier's Law Dictionary, I can support that with maybe American jurisprudence and then maybe a citation from the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, my opponent has to overcome that. And if he can overcome it with better authority, newer law, a newer decision, he can prevail, he can defeat me. If he can't, he most often is going to lose. And after all, and when we deal with law, we come in with a controversy, a real earnest controversy at issue under Ashwander versus TVA. We walk in the door and we present our sides. I put up my side, Ray, you put up your side. The judge looks at the relevant law and he arrives at a conclusion. And we have rules that we follow to arrive at that conclusion. And those rules are laws. After all, if you look at law in this regard, law in reality is nothing more than rules. It's like playing a board game. It's like playing, you know, a game and we're sitting here and we play this game by the rules. And when a guy breaks the rules and sticks a card up his sleeve, see, he's breaking the rules. He's cheating. And so we don't like cheaters. We don't like people that break the law because breaking the law is cheating. And we all subscribe to this law. We all subscribe to this code and we all practice the same law. And if we all do that, we don't have any problems. Problems develop when somebody cheats in the game. You know, you're playing Monopoly, and somebody doesn't follow the rules that are set down. Who makes the rules for Monopoly? I guess it's Milton Bradley. I guess the guy that invented the game, I guess the manufacturer of the game, makes the rules. And when we play the game, you know, we can change rules. Oftentimes, I've come up with board games and said, no, I don't like that rule. And I've had other members of my family say, you know, I don't like that rule either. I think it's kind of stupid. Why don't we change that rule and follow this principle or follow this rule? Hell, sometimes we play board games here and we have our own rules. We've changed Milton Bradley's rules. And that's what Congress does. A lot of times Congress changes the rules. A lot of times Congress takes a law, you know, from the Bible and they change that. They change the rules. Of course, God told us not to do that, but then, you know, sometimes we do what we're told not to. Hey, we're at the halfway point here. I got to make an observation here and a couple of statements for you. I want to remind you that you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website, georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It's open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. Now, for more information, just go to the homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Remember, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just call the law school direct, 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Keep in mind, too, that the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website, georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about law. Where is it in the law? Can you find it in the law? This process, finding it in the law, is called code pleading. Code pleading. It's the methodology whereby a lawyer or a judge looks up assertions and facts that are made by opposing counsel to arrive at a conclusion or a policy. So when you go into the U.S. Supreme Court and one side is talking abortion, the other side's talking anti-abortion, and the court has to come up with a decision, we base it upon the rules. So the U.S. Supreme Court has a basic rule book called the Constitution of the United States. That's really all they're concerned with. The Supreme Court of the United States doesn't care if you're guilty or innocent. And it's very seldom the issue. You know, this guy, Miranda versus Arizona, you know, Ernesto Miranda, hell, the guy was guilty as hell. I mean, he was a murderer. He was a killer. But the issue to be decided didn't have anything to do with whether or not he killed somebody or whether or not he was a good guy or a bad guy. It had to do with whether or not the police can extract confessions out of Miranda or you or me or anybody else without first informing us that we have a right to counsel present, we have a right to remain silent. A constitutional right. And so the rule book, the rules that they're following here is the Constitution. And oftentimes the Constitution gets in the way of good law. Or good law. Well, the law, the way we would like to enforce it or interpret it. And so the Supreme Court weighs in from time to time and says, well, wait a minute. You can't play the game that way, Mr. Policeman. I mean, you know, your job is to go out here and arrest the bad guys, but you can't come out here and arrest bad guys and then just beat the hell out of them and make him confess and then take that confession in and convict him with it. I mean, it's a hell of a lot easier to beat a confession out of somebody than it is to go out and do objective police work and get the evidence against the guy and come in and convict him. Now, in dictatorial countries like China and Russia and Germany and so on, you know, we're just interested in the law as we see it, and so we just beat the hell out of people. And that's one of the problems that the Bush administration has, is sending people over to countries where they can beat information out of them. Since we don't practice that here under our law, our legal system in the United States, the Bush people are sending these people that they're capturing, these Al-Qaeda guys, or guys they think are Al-Qaeda, over to Saudi Arabia, where they don't have the niceties of a constitution, a bill of rights, or due process of law. And they just beat this guy, and if they need to kill him, they kill him, and if they don't, they torture him or whatever they need to do to get the information. Well, they've got their rules in Saudi Arabia, and we've got our rules over here. That's all. That's all you're dealing with here in law is rules. And some guy comes along and says, well, my rules are better than your rules. Well, again, that's the basis of war. The Germans said our rules are better than Russian rules, and they attacked the Russians and said, we're going to change your rules, and we're going to change your government, and we're going to dominate you people. And, of course, the Russians said, well, we don't think we're going to do that this week. And that was called World War II. And sometimes that happens on a local level, you know. Some guy gets it in his head that he's going to do this, that, or another thing, and so he goes over here and says, well, you know, I think Circle K's got a lot more money than I do, so I'm going to go in and rob them. And so then we have this policeman, he comes along and says, well, not this week. You know, we're not going to sit still for that. We're not going to allow that. Well, where is that written in the law? Where is it written in the rules? Well, the first and foremost and primary book that we go to when we're looking up law is your state statutes, state code. And then, of course, Raymond asks this question, and he asks it this way. He says, is there any law, case, record, or statute? Well, yeah, there's a law, and that law is written by statute. And it's written in your code book. So here's what happens. The legislature enacts a law, and they say, thou shalt buckle thy seatbelt. And they get two houses here. You got to except in Nebraska, where they only have one, but most states have two houses. They'll have a House of Representatives and a Senate. And both those houses have to agree that that's the law that we want to have here in Missouri, thou shalt wear thy seatbelt. And then the governor has to agree to it, and he has to sign it. And if you get an obstructionist government or governor that doesn't want to sign it, well, then you got to pass it by, well, in some cases, like a constitutional amendment by 75% of the states. Got to agree to it. You don't have to have a unanimous verdict like a jury verdict, but, you know, you got to have a clear-cut majority, 51%, sometimes 60%, sometimes 66%, sometimes 75%. You know, there's various numbers that come in here. So here's another thing we need to learn about law, and that is the law is different in different locations. The law in California may be different than the law in New York. But that doesn't mean that we can't use the law in New York and California. And we have a term that we follow in law. It's called dicta. D-I-C-T-A. Let me give you an example of dicta. One time I was doing a case, a custody case over in Oklahoma. And the mother of this child that was in litigation was a drug addict. And when she was pregnant with this baby that was the subject of the litigation, she was taking various illegal drugs. Now, in California and New York, as I recall, this is 20 years ago now, but as I recall, those were the only two states that had enacted legislation and declared that a mother who is taking illegal drugs while she's pregnant is causing child abuse, is guilty of child abuse. Oklahoma had never made any such law. So I found that in those two states, and Oklahoma didn't have any rule concerning it. So I alleged that by dicta, that is, it's not the law of Oklahoma, but it's the law of California and New York, that in cases where we're deciding custody, if I was in California or New York, I could come in here and I could say, as a matter of law, this mother is guilty of child abuse simply because she was taking these illegal drugs. Now, we could prove she had been taking these illegal drugs. In fact, I think she admitted to that while she was pregnant. Now, the judge in Oklahoma could accept those laws in New York or California, or he could reject those laws. He didn't have to accept them or reject them. In this particular case, he did. He looked at that, and in his opinion, he noted that while Oklahoma had not made a decision, had not enacted a law, that he could, because he has judicial discretion. Why do judges have judicial discretion? Well, I don't know. I didn't make it that way. But if you want to look up judicial discretion, you look it up in the legal dictionary, and you'll find out that there's a lot of cases, a lot of precedent along that line. And you'll find in law that we follow a lot of case precedent. All of the states of the union follow Miranda versus Arizona because it comes out of the highest court in the land. Now, the Supreme Courts of California and New York are the highest courts in those two states, but the Supreme Court of New York doesn't have any authority over law in California. Now, the reason I point this out is that we get a diversity of opinion. One guy will say, well, I believe this, and another guy says, I believe something else. Well, in his state, that's the way it is. You know, up in Vermont, I think it's Vermont, don't cite me per se on this, but I believe Vermont's the state that doesn't have any concealed weapon law. I think there might be another one or two states. Hey, hell, you can carry a concealed weapon in Vermont. Just, you know, stick your .45 under your armpit, walk down the street, and everything's copacetic. Now, if you do that here in this state, Missouri, I think we just enacted a law here in this state. You have to have a permit for a concealed weapon. And you got to have a permit. And if you don't have a permit and you get caught, then you're subject to the penalty. And I don't know what the penalty is, but, you know, let's say the penalty is a $500 fine or a year in jail or whatever it might be. Well, the guy in Vermont, he says, well, the law is you can carry a concealed weapon anytime you want. And he's telling you the truth. He's not quite telling you all the truth, because if that guy from Vermont is carrying that concealed weapon here in Missouri, he's going to be in deep doo-doo just like I would be, except that there is an exception to the law called, let's see if I remember the term here, called full faith and credit. Full faith and credit. Let's suppose this guy from Vermont's carrying heat, and he gets in his automobile and he's traveling across the country, and for some reason he gets caught packing heat here in Missouri. He could come into court and assert as an affirmative defense full faith and credit of the laws of Vermont because he's a citizen and resident of Vermont. I don't know how the local court would view that, but on appeal, he'd win. If he took that up to our state Supreme Court, our state Supreme Court would say, well, we're going to give full faith and credit to the laws of Vermont. What if George Gordon did that? I come into court and say, well, my God, if this guy from Vermont can use full faith and credit, why can't I? And the court would say, well, where do you live? I live here in Isabella, Missouri. So, well, you're a resident of Missouri. Yeah, but so what? Vermont has a law over here, and they say you can carry a gun concealed. And our Supreme Court said, well, Gordon, come on, Gordon, but you're not from Vermont. Now, we're going to cut this guy from Vermont a little slack because he is from Vermont and he didn't know the laws of Missouri and in fact isn't subject to them because he's following the law of his state. You know, so we have these rules and regulations. Where do I find these rules and regulations? Well, why don't you look up full faith and credit in Bouvier's Law Dictionary or in American Jurisprudence or Corpus Juris Secundum? And you'll find these principles are articulated in various cases that have been decided in the past. And you'll see some footnotes at the bottoms of these pages, and they'll cite cases, and you go to those cases. And then you'll find that that's the way the game is played. Now, you may sit there and say, well, that's not right. That guy from Vermont, when he gets caught packing a gun in Missouri, he should go to prison just like anybody else. Some other guy comes along and takes the other side of the argument and says, well, wait a minute. No, this guy's from Vermont, and up in Vermont, they practice a different law than we do in Missouri. And how could the guy in Vermont know all the laws of Missouri? I mean, if you think about it, the guy in Vermont would have to know the laws of every state that he was traveling through, wouldn't he? And how many laws is that? Well, it's 2.5 million. It's a physical impossibility. Now, we have basic traffic laws. No, in the United States of America, we drive on the right side of the road. And to you people in England, you look at us and say, you know, those Yanks are just backwards. Well, maybe we are. I don't deny that. I don't know whether driving on the right side or the left side of the road is the best system or not. I just know that here in the United States, you got to drive on the right side of the road if you want to get from here to there, because I don't think you could get from here to Springfield driving on the left side of the road. I know a lot of people would get real angry with you on the trip, but I'll tell you that. So we all follow a rule here, and we follow that rule. It's drive on the right side of the road. Furthermore, if you don't drive on the right side of the road, the first highway cop that sees you driving on the left side, he's going to stop you and ask you what the hell you're doing. Who are you passing? Or, you know, what's the story? And then they're going to take you into court, and they're going to prosecute you, and they're going to say, hey, this guy was driving on the wrong side of the road. Now, yeah, I think it just makes common sense that all of us have to agree that if we're going to get along together, that all of us have to drive on the right side of the road, or we got to drive on the left side of the road. We got to come to an agreement. And so to do that, we have a legislature, and the legislature comes up with a law. It says we're going to drive on the right side of the road. Well, what do you think would happen here in the United States of America if the legislature of California said, let's drive on the left side of the road? Then the legislature of Nevada says, let's drive on the right side of the road. And then the legislature of Colorado says, now let's drive on the left side of the road. And then Utah's right side. And, you know, I mean, my God, you'd have to change from one side to the other all the way across the country, wouldn't you? So we have a thing here in the United States called the Commerce Clause. It's called interstate commerce. And our founding fathers years ago said that what we're going to do is we're going to have uniformity in commerce. We're going to come up to a conclusion, then we're going to make a law, and we're going to have that law enforced universally. And so we do that in the United States, and the Congress of the United States has that duty. And they have the duty on money. And so Congress decides that we're going to have Federal Reserve notes. California doesn't get in on that. And so because of that, we have these laws that come out of the Congress of the United States. And the Congress has the field. It's called the field here. And Congress occupies that field. And they make those laws. And the states all follow those laws. How do I know that? Well, because the U.S. Supreme Court reports, which is a big set of books here. I'm just going to look up here. I don't know how many volumes, but I'm looking up on the wall here, and I'm looking down here at 300, we're up to 400 volumes, U.S. Supreme Court reports, 400 volumes now. And these volumes are pretty thick volumes. They probably have 500 pages each. And some of the Supreme Court reports, I imagine they're twice as thick. I imagine they got 1,000 pages in them. And they've got all this information in there. This is what we call doing legal research. then there's a system. I'll cover a little of that with you as we progress along here. And you do this legal research. So Ray is asking the question, if you could point me in the right direction, he says. Well, I could do that, Rick. And I teach a school here on courtroom strategy and procedure. Courtroom strategy and procedure. In which one of the lessons, 28 things that you need to know in courtroom strategy and procedure, is this thing of code pleading. How do you find this information? Where do you go to get this information? In some cases, you go to the Supreme Court reports. In some cases, you go to the statutes. In some cases, you go to the legal encyclopedia. In some cases, you go to the Bouvier's Law Dictionary. In some cases, you make a combination of all of the above to find out where is it in the law. And sometimes you can't get a good, clear picture from the statute by itself. I mean, I can read a statute and I say, God, what does that mean? So then I take that statute, we'll have a footnote under it, and I'll go to our state Supreme Court and I'll look that up, and the state Supreme Court will cite 4 or 5 cases, and you read those 4 or 5 cases, and they pretty well explain how that statute has to be construed and how that statute has to be applied. And that's what we're dealing with here when we talk about comity. A court out in California doesn't like to contradict a court in Vermont. And that's why we have various rules that cover those kinds of incidents. When we have an incident, a case, we call it in law, a case, an incident, a confrontation, a question, a policy decision that has to be made, courts try to get along with one another. And that's why we have these various and sundry rules that come out of the Congress or come out of the Supreme Court of the United States in order to rectify problems that could come up, like full faith and credit. What are we going to do with the guy? I had a student here one day. He's from Pennsylvania. He has a gun permit. He's carrying a concealed weapon. He drives his car across the border into New Jersey. He gets stopped, and they confiscate his gun. It really wasn't that big a deal. He's got a gun permit from Pennsylvania. Full faith and credit is the proper form. He should walk in and plead full faith and credit, non-assumpsit by way of confession and avoidance. Sometimes lower courts make the wrong decisions. You take it up to the appeals court and they give him his gun back. As it turned out, he lost his gun. He came here to law school and said, well, that isn't right. No, it isn't right, and you didn't know how to get your gun back. You didn't know how to follow the procedure. And oftentimes things like that come up, and you'll read about it in Reader's Digest, and they'll say that's outrageous, and it's unfair, and it's unreasonable. No, that's really not quite the case. These laws are pretty fair. They are pretty reasonable. Our problem in America is that most Americans do not know how to use the rules that are available to them. And that's why I always suggest courtroom strategy and procedure, and that you learn the law so that you know how to solve that problem. Number one, you want to learn how to avoid the problem. And then number two, if the problem comes up, how do I solve that problem? Where do I go to get the information? We're just about out of time here, Ray. We'll be back tomorrow night, same time, same station. We'll take it up right here. We're talking about the law. Where is it in the law, or where does that law come from? We'll take it up right here next time. All right, you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. Remember, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just go to the website georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. Remember that the Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. And the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. All right, that's it. We're out of time. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.